I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Excessive ambitions and vested interests have led to treason, betrayal of the country, its people, and the cause for which the soldiers and commanders of the Wagner Group had fought and died for, side by side with our other units.
Russian President Vladimir Putin tries to restore calm after a short-lived armed mutiny launched Friday by the Wagner mercenary group comes to an end with a deal that exiles the group's chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, to Belarus and drops all charges against those who joined the rebellion that reached the outskirts of Moscow, though even the dropping of charges is unclear at this moment. We'll host a roundtable discussion starting in Moscow with Nina Khrushcheva, New School professor, great-granddaughter of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, and we'll go to Kyiv to get response and speak with an expert on the Wagner Group. Then dueling rallies in Washington, D.C., as pro-choice and anti-choice activists mark the first anniversary of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Vice President Pence led the anti-choice activists.
Because of your work and because of your prayers, the Supreme Court of the United States sent Roe versus Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs and gave America a new beginning for life.
We'll get an update on the state of abortion access in the United States a year after Dobbs. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military has withdrawn troops and tanks from the streets of Moscow after the head of the Wagner mercenary group called off a short-lived armed mutiny he launched Friday. Wagner fighters stopped their advance on the outskirts of Moscow late Saturday after officials reached a deal that guaranteed their safety. They also withdrew from the southern Russian city of Rostov, which they had seized, and returned to their bases. As part of the deal, the Wagner chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, agreed to go into exile in Belarus. The Kremlin also said he and his fighters would avoid criminal charges despite the revolt. On Saturday, Putin made a brief national address in which he refrained from mentioning Prigozhin by name, but denounced his actions as treason.
We will protect both our people and our statehood from any threats, including internal betrayal. And what we are facing is precisely betrayal. Excessive ambitions and vested interests have led to treason, betrayal of the country, its people, and the cause for which the soldiers and commanders of the Wagner Group had fought and died for, side by side with our other units.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the revolt by Wagner mercenaries had exposed chaos in Russia. After headlines, we'll go to Moscow and Kyiv for the latest. In Sudan, fighters with the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces stormed the headquarters of a heavily armed police unit in Khartoum Sunday, seizing stockpiles of weapons and ammunition. Since Saturday, there have been reports of intense airstrikes and artillery fire across Sudan's capital in the western Darfur region. Witnesses say fighting killed at least a dozen civilians Sunday. Witnesses say RSF fighters have joined Arab militias in a campaign of ethnic cleansing in Darfur. UNICEF reports fighting in Sudan has now displaced 2.5 million people, with at least 330 children among the dead. In Syria, at least 9 people were killed and dozens more injured Sunday as Russian warplanes attacked rebel-held parts of the northwestern province of Idlib. In the bloodiest attack, a Russian fighter jet bombed a vegetable market crowded with shoppers. Guatemala's presidential election is headed to a runoff after no candidate received over 50% of votes needed to claim victory Sunday. Former Vice President and First Lady Sandra Torres of the centrist party National Unity of Hope appeared to be in the lead. Torres previously ran for president twice and has been accused of corruption and campaign finance violations. Congressmember Bernardo Arevalo of the Progressive Movimiento Semilla Party placed second, surprising many. He's the son of the former president, Juan José Arevalo, who pushed for revolutionary social reforms when he was in office from 1945 to 1951. Semilla has promoted the protection of human and indigenous rights, press freedom, and policies combating the climate crisis, among other measures. In Sierra Leone, voters took to the polls to choose a new president over the weekend amidst a catastrophic economic crisis and spiraling living costs. Current President Julius Maada Bio and his main opponent, Samora Camara, have both claimed victory, though official results have yet to be released. Violent clashes erupted following the election, with police firing tear gas at supporters of the All People's Congress Opposition Party as they awaited election results outside the party's headquarters in the capital, Freetown. One woman was severely wounded by the crackdown. A party representative spoke to reporters as heavily armed soldiers forced people from the building.
Just here on a press conference, and then the next thing we knew, we started hearing firing, and our whole office is surrounded by police and army. All of the vehicles around have been damaged, including that belonging to our presidential candidate. He's also upstairs. We were all tear gassed, live bullet shots.
In Greece, the conservative prime minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, is celebrating re-election after his New Democracy Party won over 40% of votes in Sunday's runoff vote. The leftist opposition party, Syriza, came in a distant second with just 20% of the vote. A newly created far-right party known as the Spartans took almost 5%, surpassing the 3% threshold to enter parliament. Mitsotakis came to power in 2019 after an anti-immigrant hate campaign in which he pledged to block the arrival of asylum seekers on Greek shores. Northern China suffered a weekend of record temperatures, with highs in the capital, Beijing, topping 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit for three consecutive days. Authorities are warning of more dangerous heat in the forecast and recommend people limit their time outdoors. This is a 28-year-old Beijing resident.
I'm definitely worried, but I think I'm still young and can handle it. But I hope the older people will go out as little as possible these days and just stay at home. The temperature outside is just too hot. If your physical strength is not good or you have high blood pressure, it is easy to get heat stroke.
Scientists are sounding the alarm over an extreme ocean heat wave in the North Atlantic, where surface temperatures are as much as 5 degrees Celsius or 9 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Marine biologists have described the unprecedented warming as a marine wildfire that threatens a mass die-off of fish, oysters, and other wildlife. In Panama, authorities are preparing to reduce the number of ships allowed through the Panama Canal and are considering new weight restrictions on vessels making the transit. A severe drought has led to a shortage of water needed for locks that help move container ships across the Panama Canal. Here in the United States, high humidity and extreme temperatures above 100 degrees Fahrenheit are forecast to continue in Texas for much of the week. Parts of southwest Texas hit 119 degrees Fahrenheit Friday, just 1 degree shy of Texas's all-time highest temperature recorded three decades ago. In Paris, dozens of heads of state wrapped up a two-day summit on climate finance Friday without an agreement to tax greenhouse gas emissions produced from international shipping. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the Biden administration would consider the proposal, which was advanced by the French President Emmanuel Macron. The climate action group Oil Change International noted leaders of wealthy nations are largely absent from the meeting, saying they missed a critical opportunity to redirect billions of dollars from fossil fuels debt and the ultra-rich to address the climate crisis. This is Mitzi Tan, a climate activist from the Philippines who joined protests on the sidelines of the talks.
We are all in this crisis together. We are not equally impacted. Countries like the Philippines will experience it a lot worse, but we all have to band together to demand for justice, to demand for no more fossil fuel finance, and to demand for debt cancellation, because that is what we need to ensure that communities and marginalized people across the world are able to access this finance and actually adapt, mitigate, and live. in this climate crisis.
Hundreds of abortion supporters rallied in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, marking the first anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn abortion rights under the 1973 ruling Roe v. Wade. This is one of the protesters, Nadine Saylor.
We need to be engaged. If we don't show up and if we don't participate, we get what we get. And what we get is our rights taken away.
The protest came as anti-choice activists also rallied in Washington, D.C. Former Vice President, 2024 Republican presidential hopeful Mike Pence told a gathering of Christian conservatives the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe was a historic victory, but said it didn't go far enough and called for a nationwide 15-week abortion ban.
Because of your work and because of your prayers, the Supreme Court of the United States sent Roe versus Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs and gave America a new beginning for life.
We'll have more on the fight over reproductive rights in the U.S. later in the broadcast with abortion access correspondent of The Nation, Amy Littlefield. Millions of LGBTQIA people and supporters took to the streets around the world to celebrate Pride over the weekend. In Turkey, advocates led rallies in Istanbul, defying a ban by the conservative government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's been condemned by human rights groups for violently targeting LGBTQIA people with hate speech and discriminatory policies. Last Sunday, a trans pride march was also attacked by Turkish police after activists gathered across Istanbul despite a ban facing repression from security forces that fired rubber bullets and tear gas at demonstrators. In Mexico City, dozens of LGBTQIA couples held mass wedding ceremonies Friday to kick off pride celebrations. This is Edgar Mendoza, who married his partner of a decade.
I feel very happy because we have been together for 10 years, and with this marriage, we got to take another step that we wanted, which is to become a more stable family. I think this document is very important. Beyond being a paper or a marriage symbol, it's the security I can bring to my family.
And in the U.S., millions participated in pride marches in hundreds of cities around the country, including New York City, Chicago, Houston, San Francisco, to urge supporters to unite and continue fighting in the face of intensifying attacks against the LGBTQIA community. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As Russian President Vladimir Putin tries to restore calm after a short-lived armed mutiny launched Friday by the Wagner mercenary group, we'll host a roundtable discussion beginning in Moscow, then to Kyiv, and we'll speak with an expert on the Wagner group. Stay with us. Smashing Pumpkins. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Russia, where the government's working to restore calm after a short-lived armed mutiny was launched Friday by the Wagner mercenary group. Wagner fighters stopped their advance on the outskirts of Moscow late Saturday after officials reached a deal that guaranteed their safety. They also withdrew from the southern Russian city of Rostov, which they had seized, and returned to their bases. As part of the deal, Wagner Group chief Yevgeny Prigozhin agreed to go into exile in Belarus, where President Alexander Lukashenko is a close ally of Putin. Lukashenko mediated the deal. The Kremlin also said the Wagner Group head and his fighters would avoid criminal charges despite the revolt, though today that's now being called into question. Today's state-controlled TV in Russia showed footage of Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu meeting with Russian military officers in Ukraine, though it's unclear when that footage was from. Also today on Russian TV, Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin made the first public comments by a senior Russian official since the deal was made.
Russia is going through an important time in its history. As the president noted, virtually the entire military, economic, information machine of the West is directed against us. We need to make calculated, unified decisions to effectively achieve goals set by the leader of the state.
This comes as Russian President Vladimir Putin made a brief national address Saturday and refrained from mentioning the Wagner Group leader by name, but denounced his actions as treason.
We will protect both our people and our statehood from any threats, including internal betrayal. And what we are facing is precisely betrayal. Excessive ambitions and vested interests have led to treason, betrayal of the country, its people, and the cause for which the soldiers and commanders of the Wagner Group had fought and died for, side by side with our other units.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said in his nightly video address Saturday, the revolt by the Wagner mercenary troops in Russia had exposed chaos in the country. At one point, he switched to his native language of Russian to address Russians and Putin.
I will say it in Russian. The man from the Kremlin is obviously very afraid and probably hiding somewhere, not showing himself. I am sure that he is no longer in Moscow. He calls somewhere and asks for something. He knows what he is afraid of because he himself created the threat. All evil, all losses, all hatred. He himself who spreads it. What will we, Ukrainians, do? We will defend our country. We will defend our freedom. We will not be silent, and we will not be inactive. We know how to win, and it will happen. And what will you do? The longer your troops stay on Ukrainian land, the more devastation they will bring to Russia. The longer this person is in the Kremlin, the more disasters there will be.
On Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Wagner Group rebellion revealed cracks in Putin's power. He spoke on ABC News.
So I think this is clearly, we see cracks emerging. Where they go, if anywhere, when they get there, very hard to say. I don't want to speculate on it, but I don't think we've seen the final act. This has been a devastating strategic failure for Putin. Across virtually every front, economic, military, geopolitical standing.
This comes as NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said Monday, the aborted rebellion demonstrates the scale of the Kremlin's strategic mistake in waging war in Ukraine.
The events over the weekend are an internal Russian matter, and yet another demonstration of the big strategic mistake that President Putin made with his legal annexation, his legal annexation of Crimea and the war against Ukraine. As Russia continues its assault, it is even more important to continue our support to Ukraine.
We begin our coverage in Moscow, where we're joined by Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, great-granddaughter of the former Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. Her books include The Lost Khrushchev, Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Professor Khrushcheva, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So this is the first show we've done since the Wagner rebellion. We haven't seen Prigozhin, though they said he's going to go into exile in Belarus. We also haven't seen Putin since he gave that speech on Saturday. And now there are all sorts of questions that, though the Kremlin said that all of the Wagner folks, including Prigozhin, would be granted, would have the charges dropped, that's not clear right now. You're in Moscow. You've walked the streets. What is the understanding of what happened among the Russian people?
Well, thank you, Emmy. There's a little bit of a relief, although in Moscow, at least, there was very kind of almost confidence, not confidence, but certainty that it's not going to go far enough. It's going to be resolved very quickly, that it's just so inconceivable, although what's inconceivable in Russia nowadays is a stretch, but that Prigozhin is not going to take over the Kremlin. Although now we're learning, for example, that about billions and billions of rubles have been taken from the banks on Saturday when it was all going on. Then the flights have been filled and the prices, the airline prices, doubled or tripled. So people were preparing for the worst. But when I walked around, even in the afternoon when the Wagner troops were going and approaching approaching Moscow, there was still sort of a disbelief that it can result in anything but resolution, which indeed happened by 10 o'clock on Saturday. Putin supposedly has won. He would have won much better if indeed, as you mentioned, after that very fiery speech and very angry speech, because Prigozhin was his creation. Prigozhin exists because Putin fed him, allowed him to be, allowed these military mercenary groups to be formed. If Putin on that Saturday night, when Alexander Lukashenko said, "We resolved it, I helped, I'm so great," then Prigozhin came out and said, "We resolved it," when Putin himself would have come out and explained to the Russians and to everybody how that treason that he so firmly hated in the morning on Saturday, then being resolved, because it really was a military mutiny, and yet somehow they're going to be pardoned, and Putin is absolutely silent. It's not that the pardon is in question, but the Attorney General Office is saying that we're still working on it. It's still not clear how soon the charges could be dropped. So I don't think it's a question. It's whether they are continuing to have some sort of negotiation, and would be very interesting to hear when Prigozhin in fact gets to Belarus, if he does in fact get to Belarus in one piece.
If you can talk about the significance of the place where the rebellion took over, a city of over a million people, Rostov, which is really the central command of the war on Ukraine, and the fact that the Russian people, and did you see this on Russian television or in social media? And there is a question about, will Putin allow all this social media to continue? The cheering of Prigozhin by the people, people taking selfies with him. This is before we no longer saw him.
Well, yes, it was Rostov-on-Don. It's very south, very close to Ukraine. And so the speculation, we don't know, but supposedly and most likely they've been some kind of, it wasn't just Prigozhin walking, but it was a coordinated, some coordinated effort, including probably with the people in the army, because he was able to, in fact, have a meeting with two higher-ups in the Russian army. His great concern and kind of great hatred is for Minister of Defense Sergei Shoigu, and these are the people that work with Shoigu, and suddenly they were there in the headquarters, and he was kind of humiliating them, being present. So, and I think it seems to me that Prigozhin and others, there was a little bit of a hope, and clearly didn't work out the way they wanted it, that at least the some in the Russian army, in the Russian command, very disillusioned with the way the war in Ukraine is going on, would probably be more supportive. That didn't work out. So the original idea was there. That's why they were not shot on. The Prigozhinites were not shot on, but then clearly the move was fizzled out. So the question is how really, and now in the for the future, how really strong the support for Putin will remain, and how really many factions that probably are in the Russian army or are in the Russian elites, how much they will continue to gel together behind the Kremlin leader. The negotiations were going on, obviously, right from the beginning, and in some ways Prigozhin miscalculated, which left him weak. But also, if Putin came out a victor, it also didn't really show him in the strong light either. So it ends, as President Zelensky correctly pointed out, it ends to more discombobulation among the Russian elite, and also the future of Russia and the future of the war in Ukraine.
I mean, as not only a professor of international affairs, Nina Khrushcheva, but as the great-granddaughter of Khrushchev, you certainly know Russia's history well. Is this a quashed rebellion, or is this the beginning of cracks in the Putin edifice? Go back to 1991. Go back to other failed coups and what happened next.
Well, that's a fascinating question, because it is, I mean, it is a quashed rebellion in a sense, but it's also, and I would even disagree with Anthony Blinken at it's the beginning, because we've seen right from the beginning of the war, almost a year and a half ago, that there is really not much coherency in Putin's entourage. Yes, they kind of have to say they support it, but it's very unequal. Sometimes the voices for, sometimes voices against, some against, sometimes voices of more reason and whatnot, they appear. So that's that solidity that Putin was able to display until 2022 has been really waning away for the whole year plus. So this is just another moment of this kind of falling apart in cracks. I think the interesting part of this rebellion, and I cannot really speak to history here, because basically what we're seeing is Putin's a right-wing government, is a militancy and nationalism is part of its agenda. Prigozhin is a bloody nationalism, bloody militancy, almost complete fascism is part of its agenda. So we really haven't, because before, as you mentioned, 91, it was the liberals against the reformers, against the non-reformers, against the hardliners. Most coups have been like that. This is, we have one kind of latent fascism, or latent or less bloody nationalism versus extreme bloody nationalism. And that's something that I cannot remember, at least in recent Russian history, ever happening.
I wanted to go to the voice of Prigozhin. On Saturday, the Wagner chief said in a recording that was on Telegram, he'd ordered his fighters who'd been advancing on Moscow to turn around and return to their bases in order to avoid spilling Russian blood.
ЧВК Вагнер хотели расформировать.
They want to disband the Wagner Military Company. We embarked on a march of justice on June 23rd. In 24 hours, we got to within 200 kilometers of Moscow. And this time, we did not spill a single drop of our fighters' blood. Now the moment has come when blood could be spilled. Understanding that Russian blood would be spilled on one side, we are turning our columns around and going back to field camps as planned.
I mean, he had called it a march of justice, but what really changed for him to turn around? Did anything unpredictable happen? I mean, in fact, wasn't it the opposite? He met no resistance, just these cheers. And again, I want to get to, has new information been revealed to the Russian people? Seeing a top former Russian Putin ally called Putin's chef. Right. They really grew up in their political career in St. Petersburg together, attacking the whole Russian approach to Ukraine and talking about the unnecessary deaths of Russian soldiers.
Well, yes, but then he's looking and asking for more unnecessary death of Russian soldiers, because he's looking for complete mobilization, complete militarization. He actually is accusing Putin, accusing the Kremlin, accusing Ministry of Defense that the war is not going war-y enough. It should be more war. So this is all in many ways like Putin. He is very very skilled with rhetoric that is actually incredibly contradictory, because he was asking to spill more Russian blood. And another thing about the cheers, I wouldn't really overestimate the cheers. Yes, and if we see we see pictures from Rostov-on-Don, for people it was more entertainment. For people it was the heroes of the war in Ukraine going against other heroes of the war in Ukraine, because the Shoigu is a hero and Prigozhin is a hero. So it was more the sign of Russian absurdity. And I don't know if you saw that one of the Prigozhin tanks got stuck in a gate that going into circus. And it's like, well, that's kind of a symbol of what Russia is all about. So that's, I mean, the cheering is the cheering of the more to the absurdity, because the people I talked to in Moscow, they were saying, well, whatever Putin is, my God, this is the bunch of rapists and murderers. We certainly don't want to be ruled by people.